The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
We're going to spend quite a bit of time talking about the implications of the referendum vote. As you know, here on The Last Word, we had two lengthy debates on the Tuesdays before the two referendums. Last Tuesday, we dealt with the care referendum, in which Tom Clonan, sitting in the studio, made a very, very strong presentation. The previous week, we dealt with the family referendum. And I think we can say now, we weren't declaring winners. We were just putting the various contributors to where we gave them equal time. I didn't intervene on one side or the other, but certainly I think on that particular occasion, Michael McDougall and Brenda Power made stronger arguments for the no side than came from the yes side. So we have four people with us that we're going to discuss this with. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Aisling Maloney, political correspondent of the Irish Daily Mail, Daniel McConnell, editor of the Business Post, Gerard Howland, who is a public affairs consultant, former government advisor. But first, Larissa Nolan, features editor and columnist with the Irish Daily Mirror. You were one of those who strongly wrote on the no side a week in advance, and you were unsurprised by the size of the no victory. Why not?
Well, I've been writing about a no vote since December. I could see that coming along the tracks from quite a long while. Because if you're talking to women and if you're talking to mothers, you would know, especially on the care referendum, or as they called it, the care referendum towards the end. If you were talking to mothers, you would know that the pendulum had swung from the time this referendum was mooted way back in 2017. For women, you know, at the time it was all women want to work more and we're stuck in the home and all this kind of thing, or this was the narrative at least. But over those intervening years, especially with things like economic pressures, cost of living, housing, people trying to buy houses, women actually, at the pendulum had swung to, the problem being not so much women wanting to get out of the home and into the workplace. The problem was more about women wanting to get out of the workplace and have the right to be at home to raise their children. So if you had been talking to any women, or if one had been, they would know that women themselves weren't buying into this. Women weren't finding it sexist to say that actually what we do is support to the state without which the common good could not be achieved. And generally, women were not offended by that. Why would we? It's what we do. It's a part of our being.
But did you and other women not find the existing language to be somewhat condescending, that the summary of it was, even if it wasn't necessarily explicitly expressed, was women know your place, it's be in the home to provide care as a woman's role?
No, I think certain women maybe who have careers as opposed to jobs might have had time to sit back and consider the implications or the offence that may or may not be in the Constitution. But generally women, no, I think for a lot of women, the idea that being at home was somehow something to be looked down on or something to take offence about, for a lot of women, that was an offence in itself. They were saying, hang on a minute, I do the most important job that you can do in the world. So why is this being sort of looked down upon and it being called sexist? Like, if you're to look at the word, even, you know, it's old wording from 1937. You know, I don't think that you can go out and grievance seek to the point that you can call that sexist. You know, it's kind of deliberately misreading something. But, you know, even if you look at the word duties in the home, like that can be seen in a different way. That can be seen as responsibilities. And there is no doubt that we do most of that. I mean, any kind of survey that you will see will show that the vast majority of people who stay at home as the main caregiver are women. The vast majority of single parents are women. The truth.
So I'm not leaving men off the hook.
No, but that's the truth of it. So, I mean, you could say, well, we'd prefer it to be this way or it should be that way. But the fact of it is this, and is that we do most of the work and that should be acknowledged. And the state and the Constitution recognise that and recognise the value of that. And removing that was the problem for a lot of women.
OK, well, let me bring in Aisling Maloney on that as political correspondent of the Irish Daily Mail, because it could be that many women voted no, and indeed men may have voted no because they didn't want the existing wording to be removed. Or could it have been that for many, although they did want the existing wording removed, that they felt that the replacement language was not what they would want, was not appropriate to the Constitution?
I think you've kind of touched on there, Matt, like the different swathes of people captured within the no vote. I don't think it's fair to put down this quite record thumping of the no vote for the government down to one a particular swathe of people or one opinion of people. It's definitely, as you touched on there, some people not understanding, or the wording, some people not convinced of the impact of what they were voting for. And then others, as you say, who wanted to keep this provision in, and then others that weren't satisfied with the new wording of the replacement provision. But what I will say, I suppose, is, you know, there is also a lot of people who, as you say there, didn't agree with the wording that was being put forward for the future for the replacement, but also can't really sit with the fact that we still have this in our constitution. But I think in that way, the balance here, the no won out, I suppose, that kind of unknown about what you were voting for or about what the impact potentially of what you were voting for was having, and was stopping people from moving on to that yes train, I suppose. Because I do think, you know, I completely accept all of Larissa's points there on this issue, and the fact that many women will want to stay at home to have that support, or to be that support as the mother in the home and make sure that the state provides the support. But the reality is that the state doesn't support women in that way currently. And I think, you know, when you look at a constitution, you look at when it was written 87 years ago, it certainly, I think, for a lot of people, doesn't sit well with them to keep it in as it currently is. But as we know, the electorate voted to keep it in. But as I said, I don't think that was a resounding, you know, movement in favour of the current provision.
So Daniel McConnell, editor of the Business Post, could it be that the government got it wrong in that it may have anticipated that people wanted to change 87-year-old language on certain things, but made a complete hames of what it proposed to replace it with?
It absolutely made a hames of it, and it made a hames of it on many fronts. One, it rushed the wording of it. It eschewed kind of the wording from the Citizens' Assembly, and also refused to take on opposition amendments, thereby almost lining up their opponents before a football had been kicked. Had they done so, they would have at least been able to spread the blame. Had this been a cross-party consensus wording, they would have been able to.
But wasn't it essentially that, given that the only party that campaigned no against it was the one person party, Aintu?
Yeah, the only party who came out and campaigned against it was Aintu. But if you talk to Mary Lou MacDonald, you talk to Ivana Bacic, you talk to Holly Curran, all have made the point since the poll or the boxes were opened on Saturday morning. It was the government's own wording.
Hang on, that's a bit late to be pointed out. They all endorsed this. They all said yes. Isn't it a little bit about having your cake and eating it for the opposition parties
to suddenly give out to the government when they
supported a yes vote?
They supported, I suppose what their argument is that they supported a yes vote through essentially gritted teeth, that the government didn't do its homework. I think the government is also open to the charge that they didn't campaign with any sort of vigour or energy or give it any sort of kind of focus. It was akin, I made the comparison that, you know, it had the hallmarks of the campaign of Brian Cowan's first campaign as Taoiseach, the Lisbon campaign, which went down again through a similar lack of vigour and enterprise. I mean, I think it was pretty galling that the Director of Elections for Fine Gael, Heather Humphreys, I don't think did a single broadcast or newspaper interview through the entire campaign. That tells its own story. And also as well, I think Leo Varadkar and Fine Gael, you know, clearly got it into their head from a PR perspective that this would be great to run this on International Women's Day, and sort of the result would take care of itself. They benefited, I think, through the marriage equality referendum and also through abortion, that there was a kind of a coalition of the citizenry in the country that essentially took this issue beyond off the political class and did a lot of the groundwork for them. But they simply weren't there this time around, and they allowed, it was a disparate enough no campaign to kind of seize the agenda. The answers coming back from the government side in terms of the, you know, durable relationships, etc. like that, were not convincing.
Durable relationships became the punchline for a joke.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when your response is that'll be for the courts to decide, you know, it just sowed the seeds of doubt into too many people's minds, and that's ultimately why.
So Gerard Howland, does this suggest that it emphasises competency issues with this government?
At least, I mean, they have a record of not being able to deliver campaigns in general elections. Leo Varadkar is leader of Fine Gael because he would be a great campaigner, and he's lost and lost again. So there's a fundamental problem. Is it energy? Is it capacity? But they just don't seem to be able to deliver on the day in terms of votes. The last good day electorally Micheál Martin had was in the local elections in 2019, the general election in 2020 was a washout for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Here we are today, 10 weeks from local elections. It doesn't mean it'll be the same result. The result then could be quite different, but it would have to be a sea change in terms of the energy levels, the levels of conviction, the whole capacity issue around this government is low, and their energy levels are low. It's like a dim bulb that you can sort of barely see yourself in the room with.
Okay, I'm going to go back to you, Larissa Nolan, because I doubt if this in decades to come will ever be put to the electorate again, that no government will ever be brave enough to do so. But do you think, is it appropriate that given that Ireland has changed so much, that families are based in so many different things rather than marriage, that we still have this constitutional line in relation to marriage as the bedrock of the family being in place? And do you not think we do need to make changes, maybe better worded, to reinforce the importance of the woman's role in the family, but also to give cognizance and put pressure perhaps on men and others to do their bit?
So you're talking about the broadening of the definition of the relationship of family. I do think, I think it's something maybe like 27% or something like that of families now in Ireland are single parent families. But the idea that this, the fact that, you know, the fact that it's the family is based on marriage alone. Yeah, that seems to be a kind of an outdated concept. But I would say that there's nobody who's like, I was a single parent for 13 years until last year. And I don't think there was ever a time where the Constitution ever was an obstacle for me in my life, or it never dictated anything to do with myself or my son's life. I think there are other things that need to be put in place, first of all. And maybe people like myself who are single parents and had lived the life of a single parent knew that changing something in the Constitution wasn't going to particularly change our lives, or wasn't going to change economic situation or social situation. So I do think actually what was going on here was that maybe a lot of people who it was intended to help, or who they thought it would appeal to, in fact thought, hang on a minute, this is lip service. You know, again, you can name any of the issues. You know, I'm struggling to pay, bills at home, and I'm struggling with housing and so on and so forth. And now they're telling me that everything's going to be okay if I change the Constitution. So I don't think it's as important to people in general as it should be. But I think what they should have done, my ultimate feeling on this was, they should have named single parents. They should have said the family, not just based on marriage, maybe, but also includes single parents. And I felt personally, I'm not sure if other people did, that the reluctance to actually name single parents in that was something of a little bit of an insult to them. That if had they named single parents, all of us would have voted for that. I can't see that not passing.
And Gerard Holland, was there a certain implicit downgrading of marriage in that? If you are married and you end a marriage, you have to go through a process by which you have it declared to be over through divorce. Whereas now suddenly all other durable relationships were put on the same footing, but could be ended in a very different way to the ending of a marriage. That only a number of years after we moved to extend the rights of marriage to all, that this constitutional amendment was implicitly downgrading it.
Yeah, and it's a fact when somebody else gets something, you feel yourself in some way diminished. There's no rational reason for that. It's nonsense at a certain level, but it is a universal result. If you go to, for example, tax equalisation years ago, people who are married, even though it only brought single people to the same level tax-wise that they were at, it was a huge issue and some sort of an attack on the institution of marriage. So I would believe that, in a sense, some people implicitly felt that in some way. And I also think the equal marriage referendum has been misunderstood as an overwhelmingly liberal action, and it was in part. It was also in part a very conservative action that had its roots, by the way, with Republicans in the United States in the days when there were still moderate Republicans in the Republican Party, about extending the institution of marriage to gays and lesbians to include people who are outside the pale into it as an institutionalizing.
It was a strengthening of the bond
precisely,
of marriage.
Which, of course, no self-respecting feminist, including myself, would ever agree to or subject themselves to, because it is the institutionalizing of the patriarchy in society. And I've never been married because I couldn't agree with it on matter of principle. Nobody ever have me either. But
we need to take a break. There's lots more to talk about with our panel, and we will particularly talk as well about a tweet put up by Willie O'Dea today about what Fianna Fáil needs to do and what this will all do for the relationship of the government parties in advance of elections. And indeed, could it be that after the European local elections, ahead of a general election, there could be significant change amongst those parties? So we're continuing our discussion on the referendum fallout, and we're joined in studio by Larissa Nolan, who is features editor and columnist for the Irish Daily Mirror, Gerard Holland, public affairs consultant, Daniel McConnell, editor of the Business Post, and Aisling Maloney, political correspondent of the Irish Daily Mail, is with us as well. But actually, can you tell us a little bit about Willie O'Dea's tweet, Daniel, please, today? What he says Fianna Fáil needs to do as a result of this referendum defeat.
Yeah, so Willie O'Dea, who is the veteran Limerick politician and former government minister, who's not shy of a colourful phrase or two, took to Twitter 6 hours ago and said Fianna Fáil needs to get back to basics and abandon the hate speech bill, which is obviously becoming very controversial, focus on housing, health, law and order, and stop playing to what he calls the woke gallery. They need to start listening to the people, stop talking down to them, and stop listening to the out-of-touch Greens and NGOs. Now,
what's the woke gallery?
This is the... So Fine Gael, under Leo Varadkar, I think stand accused a lot of the time of trying to play to a far more liberal crowd than their own traditional base would ever think they would be. And it has driven the likes of veteran TDs within the main government parties absolutely bonkers, because they often accuse Leo Varadkar of abandoning the traditional law and order, prudence, kind of Fine Gael rural stock, essentially, of abandoning them and trying to chase what they would consider the woke vote, who will pretty much never vote for Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil in large numbers. Now, Willie O'Dea going after the Greens is nothing new. He's had countless rows with Eamon Ryan around road projects and all the rest. He famously told one parliamentary party meeting that he told Eamon Ryan to stop pissing down my back and telling me it's raining, quoting one famous Western movie from way back when. So hostilities are certainly on the rise, Matt. This is classic last year of government stuff when we're heading into elections.
Yeah.
Each party needs to start defining themselves on an individual basis. The animosities that have been kind of bubbling under the surface are now coming out, are now bubbling over. And I think you're going to see three very interesting parliamentary party meetings this week.
I'd say you are. But Larissa Nolan, how would you define the woke gallery that Willie O'Dea is talking about?
Well, I think there is a minority of people. And I think that the majority of political parties are playing to the woke gallery.
But hold on, what does it actually mean? People understand what woke means?
Well, I think what I would like to say is that you know, the real meaning of liberal, as I always say, is being tolerant of people with behaviours and opinions different to your own. And for my view of the stereotypical woke gallery, which is a group of people who are the most politically correct people, turning themselves inside out to be politically correct and all about identity politics, all these kind of things where they're pointing fingers at you and you're not, what you say is never right, and it's quite judgmental, and it's moralistic, and very, it's divisive.
Very intolerant of opposition views.
Intolerant of opposition views. So that would be, it's anything but woke, actually.
Okay, I'm looking up the definition of woke, which is alert to injustice and discrimination in society, especially racism.
Well, that's
what is wrong with being alert to injustice and discrimination in society?
But see, it's not that anymore. That's what it would have intended.
It's become a caricature of itself. It's become in the hands and mouths of pious people who are pointing and preaching. It's become a form of...
It's political correctness, identity politics and victimhood.
Okay, Aisling Maloney of the Irish Daily Mail, do you find many politicians are talking about this woke agenda and a need maybe for the government to get away from that?
I think there are, as you say, there are some characters within politics who are talking about this woke agenda. And I think I'm of the generation that's probably accused of being this woke gallery most. But what I will say is I don't think that gallery you're talking about will be bringing this up on the doors during the local and European elections, and further to that, a general election. I think potentially the woke gallery, you know, who may be largely younger voters, will actually be bringing up things like housing, as we saw 4 years ago. As you say, there are politicians who are talking about getting away from this, playing to the woke gallery, but there are also very necessary things things like stuff that is contained in that hate speech legislation needed to, you know, tackle some of that discrimination that you spoke about there when you read out the definition of woke that is needed in a modern Irish society that is much different to what we saw 87 years ago.
But Aisling, do you think, will this government now proceed with the hate speech bill, or will it quietly shelve it or allow itself to run out of time rather than getting itself in further bother before the next election?
And it has, that hate speech bill has, there's been a fuss kicked up about it in the Senedd. It was supposed to be gone through by the last all summer recess, and it was delayed and still hasn't been brought through the Senedd. There has been a kind of attempt there to slow it down. I mean, time is ticking on everything, Matt. You could say that about most of the legislation that we're looking at the moment, because we're at the cusp of, I suppose, what will happen in the next few months. Is it the government going to stay their course, which is one more year, which in a year, a lot of legislation doesn't get very far in a year sometimes. But in particular, that hate speech legislation, it's run a long course in the Dáil and has had a slowing down in the Senedd. So there are questions that have been answered, I suppose, and concerns that have been allayed in relation to that bill. But as you say, will they invest political capital in potentially being seen to play to this woke gallery by trying to get it through?
Do you think they will, Daniel McConnell?
I think if there is an opportunity for this to be slowed or delayed, or, you know, get bogged down in sort of difficult bureaucratic language, and the Attorney General's office may all of a sudden start having a difficulty with this, I think that's ultimately what might happen.
Okay. Actually, that reminds me of something, getting back a little bit. What about the Attorney General's advice to the government and the non-publication of it and the leaking of part of it at a time when those of us in the broadcast media could not actually cover it because it would have been in breach of the moratorium?
Well, clearly whoever did it for a purpose, and clearly they were completely inept at their own job.
They thought it would help the Yes campaign.
I assume so, because it was people in government that had it. So that's my presumption. Maybe I'm wrong about that. In general, I think it's not helpful to publish the Attorney General's advice, because I think governments need a frank legal appraisal on everything in real time, all the time, to think and think again about things. And having Attorney General's advice, I think, mitigates against the quality of good government over time.
Okay, is this government going to hold together now over the next year? Or a lot of people believe they can go as far as next March, Daniel McConnell, for the election. But a lot of people think that it would be the last week of October, first week of November, as the most likely time. So what do you think is now the most likely time? And can they even get that far? Because it looks like the Greens are blaming Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil for this referendum mess. And then Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are blaming the Greens for a whole range of things, which include the likes of, for example, the cap on the number of passengers in Dublin Airport and the failure to build as many roads around the country as a lot of local TDs would like.
It's definitely far more febrile atmosphere than I think we've seen at any other period of this government. And that's taking COVID-19 and everything into consideration. As I said earlier, we're at the stage where, you know, the clock is ticking in terms of legislation, wanting to get over, pet projects need to get over the line and all the rest of it. There is clearly no love lost in the backbenches of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil for the Green Party. They are sick to their back teeth of Eamon Ryan fudging, slowing down road projects, you know, constituency projects that would make a big difference to voters, etc. like that. The Dublin Airport one, I think, is one that we've covered quite a lot in the Business Post. And I think, you know, it seems to be almost being slowed down on ideological grounds from, you know, people within Fianna Fáil would say that. Michael O'Leary has obviously clearly given his perspective in relation to that. And it's the sort of atmosphere where one minor issue, a motion of confidence or no confidence, could all of a sudden tip the balance to an earlier than expected general election. Clearly, it will be determined by the three party leaders and the two ministers of finance that they are the fulcrum of the government. And if trust can remain amongst that group, then it will stay. If it doesn't, it can't.
Larissa Nolan, could the three party leaders be problems for their parties? As in, Eamon Ryan is very unpopular with a large part of the electorate, as we see from opinion polls. Micheál Martin Corden has been a long time leader of Fianna Fáil at this stage, and could it be in particular that Leo Varadkar is starting to look as if he's lost that touch that brought him in to replace Enda Kenny, and could actually be more of a political liability than an asset to his party?
Yeah, well, I think at this stage maybe the shine has gone off Leo. It was very much about, you know, Liberal Leo and his legacy, and I think this last referendum is a lot to do that with that as well. It may be a good idea, I think, for them. You know, they're not particularly doing their parties or their followers much good. But I think the major problem with politics today in Ireland is the fact that everybody is in agreement with each other. So you have an opposition, as again we saw at the referendum, as we see with hate speech, as we saw with various COVID, immigration, all the issues. They're all chiming in agreement with each other. They're terrified to say anything outside the box. God forbid it be something that 75% of the country think. But the opposition needs to get a backbone. It needs to get the courage of its conviction, and it needs to step away from trying to be popular, trying to say the right thing, and start talking about what the people want. I think the opposition have a great chance there. Not so much the party leaders, but the opposition needs to start being the opposition.
Okay, and I'll get to that in 1 second. But Gerard Holland, what about the possibility of bad local and European elections for Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and the Greens? I know it would be almost unprecedented, but would any of those parties suddenly have membership or backbench TD rebellion saying our only chance of surviving the general election would be under a different leader?
I doubt it. I don't think the internal dynamics of those parties would lend itself to that. I think Micheál Martin has such tight control over his party, it's very unlikely that people would think about it, let alone do it. And it's so lifeless. And in relation to Fine Gael, I think it would be so foolish as to be improbable.
Rather than to have maybe somebody like a Simon Harris, a new leader, bringing him into the next election?
Every single party has ever done this. Alan Jukes is the great Fine Gael example. It's always ended up being worse than it was before.
Okay. Mm. And then, Aisling Maloney, just to finish, what about Sinn Féin's position after all this? Because an exit poll over the weekend suggested that of the no voters, that the Sinn Féin membership or voters were those who were most likely to have voted no than in other parties. And here was Sinn Féin, which had taken a yes position on both referendums. Can it walk back from now appearing as if it is part of the same political establishment that presumably many of its potential voters want it not to be?
I think Sinn Féin got the call wrong here, and I think the only opposition group were the only ones to get it right. But I think that Sinn Féin, potentially what's happening there is the desire to kind of walk the tightrope between the Sinn Féin that people voted for in a large swathe, an increasing swathe in the last general election, and then moving towards that, I suppose, the Sinn Féin that needs to get a bit more of the centrist people in order to move towards being in government, and also this idea of kind of propositioning yourself more to be to be fitting of being in government. So I think that's the tightrope they're walking at the moment between those traditional voters, the change voters, and then the next sway, the swing, I suppose, in the middle that they need to persuade. And it seems they got the call wrong because, as you say there, that poll shows that most of their voters were on the no side. So I suppose the call was wrong there from Sinn Féin's perspective.
Aisling Maloney of the Irish Daily Mail, Daniel McConnell, editor of the Business Post, Gerard Howland, public affairs consultant, and also Larissa Nolan, columnist and features editor with the Irish Daily Mirror. Thank you all for being with us.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper, weekdays from 4:30. Today.